We're talking about new restrictions for Madison bars. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. No new patrons are allowed to enter at least a dozen downtown Madison bars after 1:30 in the morning on weekends. That new city restriction goes into effect today. Do you own a bar in downtown Madison? Will you establish this late night rule? Do you agree with the policy? And what do you think of late night bar entries? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jason Friedman is Central District Captain of the Madison Police Department. Captain Friedman, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, and thanks for having me, Kate. Happy to be here.
So why did the Madison Police Department want to stop downtown customers from entering bars so late at night?
So the driving concern for us was the density or number of people in a relatively small area late at night, Friday and Saturday nights at bar time. And that density was driving a lot of violent crime, a lot of concerns for safety, and a very large amount of police and other resources were being directed down into that area. And so a few years ago, we started looking at a number of different strategies and working on a number of different strategies to impact density, reduce violent crime. And the no new entry is one of many strategies that we've been able to implement with our friends and partners at in the city agencies and the ALRC.
Well, you mentioned violent crime. What other kinds of crimes do police typically see around bars around closing time on the weekends?
Yeah, so we'll see everything from, you know, minor disturbances, property damage, occasionally thefts or robberies, up to weapons offenses, substantial batteries, violent sexual assaults. And fortunately, rarely, we also, though, have had a few shootings over the years. So it runs the gamut. When you have thousands of people and a lot of alcohol, it creates a very potentially explosive dynamic, and that's what we're trying to at least diffuse in part.
It must be working to some extent because you've added more bars to this policy. Why add more taverns to the list? Why not look at restricting perhaps bar hours altogether?
Sure. So bar hours themselves are regulated by the state of Wisconsin, and so that's not set by city policy. And you know, I'm certainly not a policy wonk when it comes to some of the bureaucratic rules, but that was something that seemed beyond the ability of a local populace to have a real ability to control or moderate. And so we were looking at creative solutions, other things to try to get to something similar without having to go through that particular barrier. So we were able to do this a year ago with a handful of bars, the original seven. And based on what I saw being out there late at night, what my officers were telling me, the data, and importantly, most of the bar owners, there was a consensus that this had a positive impact. It wasn't a silver bullet. It didn't eliminate the issues, but it helped. And so the thought was, well, let's extend it for a couple of reasons. One is it seems to be working in this area, so let's see if we can get additional improvements by expanding it. But we also know that if we address an issue in one area, it's not uncommon for that issue to move. It doesn't necessarily get solved or disappear, but it does get displaced. And it was logical that if we have a lot of bars in this area that we've got this policy on, and just a few blocks away, we have a lot of bars, it's reasonable to think some of those problems might shift. So let's get ahead of that and let's put those bars on the same footing as the original bars. And then there's that consistency in a larger area trying to get to the same mitigating effect of the no new entry.
We're talking about restricting access to some downtown Madison bars on weekend nights. Madison Police Captain Jason Friedman is with us. Are you a bar owner in Wisconsin? What do you think of late night entries? Do you think this is a good idea? What are your thoughts? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, you know, We reached out to the Tavern League of Wisconsin for comment. Haven't heard back, but according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Tavern League has called the city's late night policy a slippery slope, that cities could go further in limiting access to, you know, in terms of the hours and, you know, hours a day. Has Madison considered further limiting the hours of taverns or perhaps spreading this out to more bars?
Yeah, so I mean, there are a lot of individuals and entities that are involved in the process to actually implement no new entry. So from my standpoint, just speaking from the Central District Police, you know, we're not interested in radically changing, you know, going to a much earlier time. You know, we're looking at the data, and we think the 1:30 is going to get most of what we're looking for. So we have no plans right now to alter that or to say, well, let's try 1 or let's try 12:30. We're also, you know, very much of a let's see how this works before we talk about expanding it further. There is some rationale to expand it to a larger area, but I want to make sure, and I said as much at the public meeting for the ALRC when we talked about this last, is we need to wait for the data. We need to see how this expansion works. If this expansion has a continued positive impact, then I think it's reasonable for us to, well, do we want to add another handful of bars or expand this somewhat? But we're not interested in doing a blanket approach or making significant changes just for the sake of doing them. We want to make sure that they're going to have an impact, a positive impact, and we're also trying to balance the other needs and issues that are going on in the area. So, you know, I understand their concerns, but certainly from me, that's not something neither of those concerns we're interested in exploring right now.
Captain Friedman, what happens if a bar does not follow the late night entry policy? What are the consequences?
Sure. So first, I want to say that we've had great cooperation. And to this point, my officers or patrons have not come to me and said, hey, this bar isn't following the rules. But if a bar chose not to, and certainly, you know, a one-off, it can happen. But if we saw a pattern of violation at a particular establishment that was under the no new entry, we would report it. You know, as the police officers, we would document it in a police report. And then we'd work with the city attorney's office. And there's a process that is done in that case. And the bar could be, you know, issued a financial penalty. And then there could also be some other assessments on their license. And if there were multiple repeats of this problem over a period of time, ultimately a bar could face a suspension of its license or even revocation of its license. And this could happen, you know, almost any violation or series of violations could result in this. But it would go through the process of sanction if there were those violations. So.
And very quickly, you had mentioned this is one strategy. There are other strategies the city is using to reduce crime in the downtown area. Quickly, what are some of those other things?
So we like to do a blanket approach. So we are working on environmental changes, improving lighting, changing some of the parking, working with parking, the parking ramps, adding cameras, moving the taxi stand, and a lot of those things we've already done. We're believers in education. We've met with the bars. We've offered them training. We've worked on them to change some of their policies or suggest, hey, you should put a camera in here, or you should put these signs up.
And Captain Friedman, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Captain Jason Friedman of the Milwaukee Police Department talking about new restrictions on downtown Madison bars. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We're talking about discretionary federal funding and why some states fare better than others on securing transportation grant money. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The Transportation Department's grant application deadline is just 2 weeks away for what's known as the BUILD program. $900 million is up for grabs. And for this round of BUILD grants, no more than $90 million can be awarded to a single state. But some states will have a better shot at this money than others, according to an investigation by American Public Media. What confuses you about transportation funding? What do you think about earmarks? And should we do more to limit an opportunity for quid pro quo or exchanging favors in government? Tom Scheck is a reporter for APM Reports, a national investigation unit for American Public Media. His recent piece is titled How Congress, Trump, and Obama Played Favorites with Transportation Money. And he joins us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Tom, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey there, how's it going?
I'm going well. So you've amassed so much data about transportation funding. Can you tell us about the grants you studied and how long they've been around?
Sure. We were looking at this thing called BUILD grants, which also was known as Tiger Grants under President Obama. And these grants were basically a way under the President Obama's stimulus plan in 2009 to kind of generate money in a different way to states, local communities, counties, Native American tribes, et cetera. And what they were hoping to do is get the money out the door quickly. And what they wanted to do was make them competitive. So if Madison had a project that was better than Milwaukee or Minneapolis, what would end up happening is Madison would get that project because people would rate, were supposedly supposed to rate these projects and say, okay, this scores better, it has a better economic competitiveness, it's going to help businesses thrive better, and actually it's going to move transportation folks, whether it's cars or trains, et cetera. But what we found when we started looking at this is that these grants weren't basically given solely on competitive rankings. They were also given based on politics and influence. And so we started to look at this, and what jumped out at us is we looked at these grants when they were given out by President Trump in March of 2018. And what I noticed was that there were a lot of House members at the time who were invulnerable, they were vulnerable and they were in competitive races who were getting awarded grants. And Elaine Chao was going around the country awarding these grants to these vulnerable members, and it kind of piqued my interest.
The Secretary of the Department of Transportation.
Right, the Secretary of the Department of Transportation. And so she would go out there and she'd go to Nevada and say, boy, Dean Heller, who was the Republican Senator of Nevada, he really has influence when it comes to these projects and influence over what the decisions that we make.
Let's hear a clip of that.
Senator Heller has a very strong voice in infrastructure and transportation investment. And so for all of us who come before his committee, we listen.
So, and she goes on there of saying, talking more about the relationship she has with him and his wife.
Right. And she talks a lot about how they're friends. And we should back up a little bit and say that Elaine Chao is married to Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate Majority Leader. And that couple is extremely close. They mentioned that during the speech in Carson City, Nevada, when they announced this grant. So what that jumped out at us was, OK, well, politics matters. And then also political influence also really mattered. When we looked at these grants, we found that members of a certain appropriations subcommittee, and this gets really complicated, but these folks who have they control the purse strings or the money for transportation, the transportation department and transportation funding, so roads and bridges, those individuals got more grants than individuals in other states.
We're looking at discretionary federal transportation dollars and how recent administrations have channeled that money to some states and politicians more than others. Tom Scheck is a reporter with American Public Media, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What confuses you about transportation funding? Would you like more support from the federal government for infrastructure projects? Are there infrastructure projects in your community that could use a boost? Join in in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tom, this has been happening, as you say, in both the Obama and Trump administrations. Can you explain what that looks like? How have the grant recipients changed from one president to another?
Well, the grants recipients have changed in two ways. I was looking at, I'll give Wisconsin as a really good example. So one of the ways they changed is under President Obama, he gave grants. Well, let me back up and say Wisconsin got six projects, which was actually surprised me because it was tied for 43rd in the nation since this started. And one of the reasons that I can talk a little bit about one of the reasons why you're not getting as many grants as others. But to jump off, President Obama gives more grants to urban areas. So he gave to Milwaukee and Madison during his time. And then under President Trump, He gives to more rural areas. He gave to Eau Claire, and then they also gave into the Green Bay Brown County area, and that obviously goes to political bases. Wisconsin is a swing state, and so presidents want to make sure that they're rewarding their voters who helped them get to the White House. The other thing that jumped out at us, because it surprised me, because Wisconsin is a swing state, and that was one of the factors we used. We found that. One of the reasons that Wisconsin kind of had this dry spell, and it was in between 2011 and 2013, and it's because you guys lost a lot of political influence. Senator Herb Kohl retired. He was one of those members of that transportation subcommittee I talked about. Russ Feingold lost his race to Ron Johnson in 2010. And then David Obie, who was the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, he also left. He wasn't chair, but he ended up leaving. So there's this dry spell there, and you could see Wisconsin lost a lot of political influence when it came to walking around the halls of Congress. And so that was one of the reasons that you lost out a little bit. But one of the things that we found is that what happens here is President Obama rewards the states that helped him win in 2008 and 2012. And then also President Trump has rewarded states that helped him win or regions that have helped him win in 2016.
So last year, Maine received its 14th grant in a decade for a total of $160 million. Why have we seen Maine benefit from this program so often?
Well, Susan Collins is the chair of the Senate Transportation Subcommittee that I mentioned, and she exerts extreme political influence when it comes to this. She actually bragged in one press release during the time that Maine has a winning streak that's going on, that their projects are more competitive. But when we looked at it, we found that, well, it's not necessarily that the projects are more competitive. What's happening here is that she is a fierce defender of this program. Under President Obama, a lot of House Republicans were trying to kill it under President Obama. Senator Collins said, no, I like this program. So the Senate the U.S. Department of Transportation is obviously going to reward the person who's supporting this. And then also under President Trump, she also worked hard to keep this program running. And in fact, they doubled the funding in 2018, 2019.
So in your reporting, did you reach out to Senator Collins and these other politicians whose districts have benefited from these grants?
Yeah, we did. And they declined an interview request, but they did say, hey, you know, these are competitive projects. We're not going to apologize for seeking these out. And she just can secure these grants in a manner Maine deserves. And that's what a politician is supposed to do. We should back up and say politicians are going to push for this funding. But this goes to the bigger, broader question of these grants aren't supposed to go to politicians who have a lot of political influence. What it is supposed to go to is the most competitive grants and most competitive projects, excuse me. But what we found is that we can never see how competitive these grants are, or the scoring system, I should say, that the Transportation Department uses to say, okay, this project in Maine is better than this project in Madison or Milwaukee, because the Department of Transportation doesn't share that information. We asked for it through the traditional means, and we also did a Freedom of Information Act request, but they said they didn't have to give it to us, and by law, they don't. And so a lot of folks, like in Arizona, Gila County, Arizona, they've been pushing to try and build this bridge down there for more than 10 years, and they can't get it funded. But at the same time, they're scratching their heads and wondering why not. And part of the problem is you don't understand the scoring system or the methods that are used by the Department of Transportation to say this project received 100, a scoring of 100 versus another project that received 45%.
You know, it seems that we're describing earmarks here, and Congress banned earmarks in 2011. Can you briefly bring us up to speed on that history, and why aren't we more concerned about these rules around earmarks?
Well, earmarks are pretty controversial within the public, and they poll pretty poorly. And so part of the issue here is earmarks were a way for a long time for lawmakers to kind of get projects or get money for projects in their area. And so if an individual in Wisconsin really needed a project, sometimes that individual would say, I'm not going to vote for this bill, or I'm not going to support this issue unless you give me this earmark that I want. And what ended up happening was the system got abused, because politicians would then say, okay, I'm going to give you that funding for that, but you got to support this bill. And they said that this was kind of the oil that greased the skids for legislation to happen. But at the same time, what ended up happening was the system was abused in a way that politicians, there was a politician and a lobbyist who were basically selling access to earmarks later on. So it got really controversial at a time, and then they banned it in 2011. And this, we found, is kind of the system where they're going around the old earmark system, and now they're going straight to the Department of Transportation and saying, hey, can you do this for us in a different manner?
Talking with Tom Scheck, an investigation from American Public Media reports. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about recent American Public Media reporting that looked at discretionary transportation grant funding and how political capital influences what states get money. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The House passed a package of bills last week that includes billions for the Transportation Department, and the funding includes $1 billion for the Competitive Grant Infrastructure Program, known as TIGER or BUILD. The program would be funded at $100 million above its current level. The legislation now moves to the Senate. What confuses you about transportation funding? Would you like more support from the federal government for infrastructure projects? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tom Scheck stays with us. He is a reporter for American Public Media who did this investigation. Tom, you mentioned Arizona earlier and officials there being frustrated with not winning grants for a very important project. Are there other infrastructure projects around the country that are really suffering, could use this grant money, but they aren't getting it due to perhaps that lack of political connection?
Well, you could just go to any state DOT official, Department of Transportation official, and they'll tell you we have a huge backlog of projects that we need to work on, whether it's rebuilding bridges or maintaining the existing infrastructure that they have, or new projects out there. I mean, Michigan has severe issues when it comes to bridges. So does Ohio, Cincinnati in particular. So you could just go down this list, and there's an incredible need out there in terms of transportation projects and funding for them, not just new projects, which politicians really like to talk about, but also existing projects out there where they really need to repave a road or go a little deeper with that, or fix a bridge that maybe would be considered what is considered structurally deficient, where they need to reinforce it in one way or another.
Let's explore these grants being used for election strategy. What is the connection there that you see? Can a big infrastructure development project actually influence the electorate?
Well, I don't know if it influences the electorate as so much as, like, people are going to say, boy, I'm going to end up voting for that person. But what it does do is it shows individuals who are maybe in a vulnerable district running in a critical election. What it does allow them to do is say, listen, I brought home key money for a key project out there. And it gives them the opportunity to go to a ribbon cutting or some other kind of event around that issue, and then say, I deliver for my state. And every politician loves that moment when they can go out and say, hey, I delivered this project for this state. It was because of my influence that this occurred. And in many instances, what we've seen under the Trump administration is Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao travels the country. She was in Kentucky. She was in Virginia. She was in Nevada. She was in Florida, Georgia, talking about these projects. And every time that she went to one of these states, she was there surrounding herself or with other folks who were vulnerable House members or Senate members. So that's one of the key things that occurs is that a politician could say, hey, I ended up securing this project. Traffic's going to move better because of me. And this is one of the things that I can do for you if you reelect me.
Secretary Elaine Chao has called the program, and air quotes here, earmark-like. Why is the Federal Department of Transportation complicit in this type of bartering, this give and take?
Well, part of it is because the folks who decide their funding are the same folks who ask for the money. So in a sense, when the members of the Senate Transportation Appropriations Subcommittee come out and they say, hey, we'd really like this project for Maine, or we really like this project for Washington, there is that influence that occurs. So DOT members know that, boy, if we don't give this project to Maine and Susan Collins or to Washington with Democratic Senator Patty Murray, what's going to end up happening is this could cause us problems later on when we need to get our department funded, when we want to get our priorities funded, those types of things. So that has that influence that occurs where these individuals have to think about this. I do want to say you asked me what the reaction was from Susan Collins. The Transportation Department spokespeople pretty much acknowledged to us that political influence does occur. When I asked them about this stuff, they sent me a statement and said, quote, committees on both sides of the aisle are clearly involved with the operations and oversight of the department's work. So they're actually acknowledging that Democrats, Republicans, members of these key committees are involved in this, and they play a role in how this money gets allocated.
And this is happening on both sides of the aisle, and perhaps therefore they say maybe it's okay if it's happening universally among politicians.
Well, that's part of it. I mean, but the key thing you have to remember here is that this isn't supposed to be a piggy bank where key politicians can go in and take out money. This was supposed to be a competitive grant program. That's the way it was hailed under the President Obama's economic stimulus. But what we found is that this is now turned into an earmark workaround. So what ends up happening is this no longer looks just on the face of it like, okay, we're going to award these projects to the most competitive areas out there. Instead, we're going to give them to the politicians that have influence over our department. Maybe they were going to help our friends get elected, and we're going to deliver to states that are going to help the president get elected as well.
We're talking with Tom Scheck, a reporter for APM Reports, and he looked at how politics influences federal transportation grant money. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What do you think about earmarks in government dealings? What do you think Wisconsin should do to improve transportation funding and maintain infrastructure? Are there infrastructure projects in your community that could use a boost through a competitive federal grant process? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Tom, you're in Minnesota, where in 2007 there was the I-35 bridge collapse in Minneapolis, and this was really tragic and essentially the worst case scenario when we think about infrastructure. When we look at how these grants are distributed, what about the places that are in dire straits? Are they overlooked, or are they getting the necessary support?
Well, there's an incredible demand out there. Let's just put that out there. I mean, there were recent studies that say that the nation needs to have at least I forget the number off the top of my head. I could look it up, but there's almost trillions of dollars in need out there that folks are talking about in terms of maintaining infrastructure just on its current level, and then moving forward, they need to build more things. And so what ends up occurring is that we see a lot of politicians push for new projects because those are shiny. Those are things that will be able to move product and people around the country faster. But at the same time, there's a lot of infrastructure, especially in rural America, that needs dramatic upkeep. And that's the dilemma that a lot of transportation departments face. There's only so much federal gas tax money out there that can be allocated. And so what ends up happening is the transportation departments are trying to figure out, do we go with a new project in Milwaukee or Madison or Green Bay, or do we try to maintain a bridge in Eau Claire or somewhere else? And that's the stress that's on this system right now, is that the gas tax is not has not been raised in a significant amount of time, more than 20 years. And at the same time, there is more and more need out there.
Have you seen Minnesota change its transportation funding approach since the bridge collapse? Was that a turning point in 2007?
Oh, absolutely. What ended up happening was the legislature at the time increased the gas tax, and they actually spent a lot of money trying to improve a lot of the bridges out there. This was a dramatic incident that occurred. People died, and folks were very concerned about it. And then there was a lot of scrutiny on these bridges out there to see, okay, well, what other bridges could be problematic, which ones are structurally deficient and need improvement. And so the legislature ended up raising the gas tax in 2008, and then that money was used to help with that system. But again, there's still this need out there, and it's incredible. And so there's even more demand, and folks are actually asking to raise the gas tax again in the state. And part of that's because the federal government hasn't been keeping up with its expectations, because they haven't raised the federal gas tax since the early 1990s.
And our roads infrastructure are supported by this complex combination of local, state, and federal dollars. Are we more dependent on federal dollars, or what does that mix look like, that breakdown?
Well, the mix is actually used to be a lot more federal than it was state and local, but that mix is starting to change a little bit. There still is a lot of federal money that comes in, but they can't keep up with the demand. And so what's occurring is the state and local local governments are trying to basically meet that demand in ways that they can. So they're trying to raise property taxes on the local level. Some states are trying to find innovative ways to pay for it, whether it's by tolling or private investment or by raising the gas tax. There's been a lot of states in the last 5 years, Republican and Democrat, who controlled that have raised the gas tax on the state level. But there's other states where it's just like this isn't happening. And so that's the big fight that's occurring on the state level. On the federal level, there is this frustration because the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says raise the gas tax. This will help the business community. But there's a lot of Republicans out there who say no. We should fund it with the money that we have already. But like I said, inflation hasn't kept up with demand on this. And so what ends up occurring is that it's just they're just not being able to fund as many projects.
And certainly political infighting occurs between lawmakers, as we see in Wisconsin, where transportation is such a hot issue among how do you fund the infrastructure. We're learning about the political influence and election strategy of where federal infrastructure money goes. It's the culmination of analysis over a decade that includes both the Obama and Trump administrations. Tom Scheck is our guide. He's a reporter with American Public Media. What confuses you about transportation funding? Would you like to see President Trump and other 2020 candidates make infrastructure investments a priority? Join in the conversation. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Join in with your questions, your thoughts. We'll be back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're learning about discretionary transportation funding and the influence of political capital in election strategy. A few months ago, Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao was in Carson City, Nevada to announce millions of dollars for a bike and pedestrian path. She's at the podium and she stressed how Nevada Senator Dean Heller keeps the state's needs top on her mind.
Senator Heller has a very strong voice in infrastructure and transportation investment. And so for all of us who come before his committee, we listen.
And through this reporting by American Public Media, we see a connection. Heller was considered the most vulnerable Senate Republican on the ballot last year. What questions do you have about federal transportation grants and what gets funded? What do you want to know? What are your thoughts on about how they should be awarded? Tom Scheck stays with us. He's a reporter with American Public Media carrying out this investigation into federal transportation grant dollars. Tom, transportation funding is a common election issue here in Wisconsin, like a lot of states. Why do so many states struggle to figure out how to fund infrastructure?
Well, part of the issue is that there's so many people who think that these projects are free, frankly. I mean, you talk to a lot of folks and, you know, people take for granted the fact that roads and bridges get funded. But what ends up happening is you either have to do a couple things. You have to raise the gas tax, you have to raise property taxes, or you have to find private investment that ends up having to be paid back in other different ways to fund this. And what ends up occurring is that none of these issues are politically popular. And so politicians obviously do a lot of polling, and they end up finding out that these positions aren't popular, but there's incredible demand out there, and folks get extremely frustrated when they're stuck in traffic, when they're waiting. They want, whether it's rail or other kinds of methods of transportation, and it isn't occurring. And part of the problem is, so there's the rub, right? There's the conflict. Folks think that these things should be cheaper or that they can be affordable, but at the same time, they're pretty expensive and they have to be funded in one way or another. And so that's the big dilemma. President Trump, during 2016, I think you remember, he kept saying he was going to usher in a $1 trillion infrastructure plan during the campaign. And House Democrats and Senate Democrats for years have said, well, we really want a infrastructure plan. It looked like earlier this year that there was going to be some kind of agreement, but then they start to disagree about the numbers here. House Democrats say, well, if we're going to do this, we can't just do this with privatization of roads and bridges in that manner. We want to raise the gas tax as well, which is unpopular with Senate Republicans who control that chamber. And so what ends up occurring is then there's this conflict, and there's really no way around it. You have to find a way to pay for these projects, and that's where things get really difficult.
Well, let's talk a little bit about privatizing. States could privatize some of their infrastructure funding and maintenance. What are some examples of that?
Well, what can occur, there's two different ways. One is that you can sell your existing roads to a private company. So you could sell perhaps I-94 between, I think I-94 goes between Milwaukee and Madison. It may be I-90, I forget. But and you could sell that piece of property. Indiana did that many, many years ago. And what they ended up doing that with their turnpike, they sell it to a private firm. And then that private firm can start doing tolling, or they can do other ways where they could say, okay, we're going to charge the government X percent, and then they're going to end up giving us that back over 20 or 40 years. And we promise to maintain it. We promise that it'll be okay. That's one way you can do it. The other way is that you can go to a state and say, we are going to build a new road and we'd like to make it a private road and we're going to use tolling for it. That was an extremely popular plan in the early 2000s in Texas. Rick Perry, the then governor of Texas, really pushed privatization. There was a toll road down there between San Antonio and Austin that was built, and it actually went bankrupt. The Indiana toll road that I mentioned also went bankrupt because what ended up occurring is that they couldn't generate the income that they needed to pay off the bonds that they needed. So that's the dilemma here, is what ends up occurring is you can privatize these roads, but they have to find a way to pay for it. So in some instances, what they do is they do this tolling and metering. So if you're driving in right now, maybe at 7 o'clock, it's not that busy. But between 7:30 and 9 o'clock, they can toll it and say, well, we're going to charge $15 to be on that toll road. And so what it ends up doing is creates a lot of conflict where folks who don't want to pay the toll get frustrated because they're stuck in traffic. But the people who are willing to pay the toll end up zooming on by and getting to work a little bit faster than everywhere else. That gets to be a frustrating thing as well. And that actually ended up in Texas's example, where I talked about a lot of private tolling that has occurred. There's been a lot of pushback in recent years because they don't like this plan the way it was created under Rick Perry.
So if the toll road goes bankrupt, what happens to the road? I mean, do you shut it down?
No, they don't shut it down. So what ends up happening is somebody else usually buys it through the bankruptcy court, and then they try to figure out other ways to finance it. So the initial financiers lose a lot of money on this. The state and the states don't lose money, nor do the county governments. But at some point, there has to be a commitment there to maintain those roads. That's part of the contract that occurs. And so when it goes bankrupt, it could go back to the state, but in many instances, another developer will end up coming in and buying it, and maybe they'd find a different way to do it. That's what occurred in Indiana and also in Texas.
We're talking with Tom Scheck, a reporter for American Public Media. Tom, you looked at transportation funding all across the country. What differences have you noticed between states that use a gas tax versus tolling versus vehicle registration fees? Is there a silver bullet of a funding model?
There's no silver bullet. That's the big thing here. And what has ended up occurring is that this has been neglected for a long period of time as we built new roads and new bridges. A lot of the existing infrastructure was ignored. And so what has ended up occurring is there's the demand for new things, and then there's also the demand for maintaining the old things. And those bills, because the highway system was created mostly or ushered in through President Eisenhower, a lot of those bills are starting to come due because it's 50, 60, 70 years later where those projects now need to be maintained or overhauled, or instead of just paving over things, they have to actually go back in and fix those projects. What's ended up occurring is that there's incredible stress on the system and there's more and more and more need. What a lot of folks say is, well, maybe do a little bit of everything. Maybe you should raise the gas tax a little bit. Maybe license tabs should be another example. Maybe sales tax should be an example for metro areas, because then you could get rail. And then also the other thing is maybe put some toll roads out there, but put them in areas where folks are going to be willing to pay. Maybe you do it in a system where two lanes are toll roads and two other lanes are not, and you make the developer commit to both of those. And so it's an instance where everybody's going to benefit from that. But the silver bullet issue is – silver bullet is not there at all.
As we start to wrap up here, you mentioned the federal gas tax hasn't been raised since 1993. Are federal authorities mirroring what's happening at the state level, that politicians just are reluctant to raise taxes for infrastructure projects?
Well, all you have to do is look at the federal government and see that they don't want to raise taxes at all right now. So that's part of the issue. But they are starting to notice that there is this stress on the system. President Trump has talked about being open to raising the gas tax. Democrats in the House and Senate say they want it. Senate Republicans don't support it. There are some House Republicans that do, but if you probably poll the majority, they do not. And so that's the dilemma that's occurring. In many instances, states are leading the way because they see that there's this frustration out there. People don't want to be stuck in traffic. They get frustrated by this. And so states have started to say, all right, we need to actually start to raise our state gas taxes to help pay for these projects. But on the federal level, there's this conflict and almost inertia when it comes to this. And there's no way to really be seen out of it at this point. Now, that could change. Obviously, the president has the bully pulpit. If he really wants an infrastructure plan going into the 2020 election, he could kind of maybe put some influence on Senate Republicans to say, this is going to help us. This is important. But at this point, that has not occurred. Infrastructure has not been a key priority, despite the president saying it is.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Tom Scheck is a reporter for American Public Media. He did investigative reporting for APM Reports on federal transportation grants, and he joined us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.